Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Chris Benneke on James Madison and the spirit of moderation in the Bill of Rights.
Madison, at one point, I think, partly to call the bluff of those who were thinking about the federal government's powers and wanted to restrict it, proposed in the first Congress that they actually restrict what the state governments could do and forbid them from infringing on religious liberty. But for one reason or another, we don't know why, there's very little evidence surrounding it, this particular draft of the First Amendment was rejected. And so what we ultimately got was a First Amendment that only applied to Congress. But there was at least a possibility considered at one point, that were at least proposed by Madison, that the First Amendment applied to the states, which is where he thought the real work needed to be done.
Chris Benneke next. Today, we dip into American history with a discussion about James Madison, the primary drafter of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, known as the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment addressed religious liberty, among other things, in what are known as the religion clauses. History professor Dr. Chris Benneke writes about how Madison approached this amendment in his piece, James Madison and the Moderate Origins of the Religion Clauses.
What planted this particular topic in your mind, thinking about the moderate origins of our religion clauses?
I guess I've been working in this field for a while now, maybe 3 decades or so, 2.5. But anyway, I had been working on this particular book about the free exercise clause of the First Amendment for maybe a decade or so, and various aspects of it. Wasn't intending actually to write a book initially, and was going to write about something else, about public education, and then just found myself writing about various aspects of the First Amendment and its religious clauses especially. At some point, needed to introduce the subject and then landed back on James Madison, which is not at all unconventional, and looked at his approach to how he thought about religious liberty and his initial reluctance, especially to advance the Bill of Rights. So as you and your listeners, I'm sure, know, he was among the primary designers of the Constitution itself. They'd spent all summer in 1787 working on this. And at the very end of that summer, a couple of delegates proposed that they add on a Bill of Rights, or they incorporate it into the document. And very few other delegates wanted anything to do with this. They were tired, they were homesick, and they didn't see all that much need for it. And Madison maintained that position in the ensuing months, even as the Constitution ran up against a fair amount of opposition from what we call anti-federalists, many of whom had deep Baptist commitments in Virginia and elsewhere. And he maintained this position. He wavered here and there, and he heard from Thomas Jefferson about it, and then eventually heard from people like John Leland, who was a Baptist leader in Virginia, much more forcefully about it. And partly because of the opposition to the Constitution in places like Philadelphia and in Boston, the concessions were made, and eventually many people who favored the Constitution, the Federalists, came around to it. Madison's journey to get there is one, again, that we know a lot about, people have written quite a bit about, but what astonished me about it was how long he maintained his opposition to a Bill of Rights, in particular to an amendment that protected religious liberty, because he'd been such a diehard supporter of religious liberty for so long, since before the Revolution itself, that it kind of astonished me that he wouldn't have, been among the first advocates for something like this. So that story of how he came around to supporting a First Amendment, sort of reluctantly and very slowly, seemed like a good place to introduce the religion clauses themselves.
I guess laying the groundwork for where this story begins, obviously, you have the American War for Independence. Now they're drafting this Constitution. And I think you start looking at, the drafting of the Bill of Rights and Madison's proposing the Bill of Rights, and particularly the religious liberty rights. You say that revisiting this Constitution after it had just been ratified with amendments so soon after its ratification struck many as both unnecessary and risky. And in that, historical context, why that is?
Madison, after having constructed this thing which took a lot of compromises in many months and seemed very delicate by August, September of 1787, thought that it needed to be preserved just as it was, and that this contrivance, if it were altered in any way, might lose its integrity and also might end up losing the very tentatively constructed support that it had. So for those reasons, and also because, as you probably know, the federal government wasn't supposed to do much. So Madison and his Federalist allies who supported the Constitution didn't see a whole lot of reason to append or incorporate a Bill of Rights into the Constitution, given that it wasn't going to threaten those rights. And anti-Federalists, a lot of religious dissenters again, thought differently and thought that this government did, in fact, contain that potential, and so wanted to make sure that there were protections against it. So again, Madison had to come around on that, and then he also had to give in or at least concede that this document, this mechanism, could be altered without completely undoing it.
A little earlier here, you mentioned that Madison didn't think that the Bill of Rights was necessary. I guess in that regard, maybe the anti-federalists were sort of correct. We have sort of ended up with a very large, bloated federal government. But at that time, what concerns did opponents of the Bill of Rights have, and where did they come from?
Where there were longstanding worries about government encroachment on religious liberty. It was beginning in the 16th, 17th century, probably because of the violence during the Marian persecutions. You know, people knew about the St. Bartholomew's massacre in France. Many of them had read vivid accounts, lurid accounts of religious violence in the 16th and 17th centuries and before that. And so people were well aware that religion contained the potential for severe persecution and violence. In the 18th century, there wasn't nearly as much of it. Things had settled down religious in terms of religious conflict. There were still these global conflicts that contained some religious elements during the course of the 18th century, but those generally were not denominational wars or theological ones. So much of it had died down, but nonetheless, people had this memory, this vague memory of violence that had occurred when religious rights had not been protected. And they had experienced more mundane forms of persecution in the ensuing decades. So in Virginia and in Massachusetts, places like that where religious liberty wasn't protected, and they had an established church, in those places, religious dissenters experienced inequality at the least and persecution at most. There were pretty harrowing incidents of people in Madison's Virginia, 1773, 1774, Baptist ministers being harassed, being dragged from their pulpits. So people were well aware that that could happen. In Massachusetts, which retained still a legacy of its Puritan founding, there were also restrictions on Quakers, on Baptists, on Anglicans in that colony, in that province. So it was an era in which people were still experiencing, if not directly, indirectly, some religious inequality, and even in some cases, what we'd probably call persecution. So it was a live matter for them, and they knew that things could turn differently with a different group of leaders in power. Most people thought Madison and Jefferson and Washington would be decent governors of the people, but there was always the potential that somebody who was not as circumspect in terms of the exercise of power might gain the reins of the federal government.
I can imagine people today applying, some of our presentist abilities, you know, applying principles that we understand today to the people and their actions of the past. But if there was such widespread religious persecution still across the 13 states, why did Madison and, other framers of the Constitution, from what you describe, it sounds like a lot of the framers of the Constitution, nevertheless still opposed actually codifying a right to religious liberty?
What would happen by the 1780s, especially late 1780s, is that those memories and the direct experience of persecution had really waned quite a bit. And in places like Virginia, they had provided for religious liberty. So groups were now experiencing a degree of freedom from religious constraint, from the strictures of an established church that was unprecedented. You know, outside of the Netherlands and their colonies across the globe and a few other spots, most places in the world that they knew contained an established church religious restrictions, but not here. So in Pennsylvania and New York, in Virginia by 1786, we don't have established churches. What we have instead are a variety of voluntary religious organizations that compete with one another for adherence and are generally free to say and do what they please. So looking at that and what had happened there, and also the liberating trend that they were seeing, even in places like Massachusetts and in other states that had religious establishments at the time, things looked pretty encouraging from the perspective of someone who favored religious liberty and was not directly experiencing or had not directly experienced religious persecution. So they looked at the culture and they said that there probably isn't much of a need for it. Moreover, if there is going to be religious persecution, it's going to happen in the states. It's going to emanate from Boston, you know, it's going to be in Massachusetts, and it's going to be due to things that state does and the churches in it do, and not due to what the federal government does. So to the degree that religious oppression will persist in this new nation, it's going to happen at the state level. So there's not a whole lot we can do it. Madison, at one point, I think, partly to call the bluff of those who were thinking about the federal government's powers and wanted to restrict it, proposed in the first Congress that they actually restrict what the state governments could do and forbid them from infringing on religious liberty. But for one reason or another, we don't know why. There's very little evidence surrounding it. This particular draft of the First Amendment was rejected. And so what we ultimately got was a First Amendment that only applied to Congress. But there was at least a possibility considered at one point, or at least proposed by Madison, that the First Amendment apply to the states, which is where he thought the real work needed to be done.
I find that interesting, especially given our political climate has changed since the founding. But it's so interesting that from what you describe, like historically, it sounds like the founders were much more states focused and more concerned about amending the Constitution to limit the federal government rather than, you know, what we see is, for instance, decisions from the Supreme Court giving us rights that limit the states today. What happened? How have we flip-flopped to be more federally focused than state-focused?
That's probably a whole nother story that you know, takes place over decades and really starts to shift in the 1930s and thereafter. You know, we do get a much more robust administrative state than we had in the past, where the federal government plays a more direct role in terms of education, provision of health care, things like that, regulation. In those instances, people start more regularly coming in contact with the power of the federal government. They had not before. And this means, of course, that the religious liberties that had previously protected people from a relatively limited federal government now are called into service of protecting people in these new spheres, healthcare, education, where they had not been necessary before. People had not felt them necessary before. And they also take on a kind of new expression that is increasingly, it's not that the government oppresses your particular faith, right? No one's saying you can't worship or you have to pay taxes to the established church. You know, that we're long past that. There's no danger of violence against you. If you're a pacifist, for example, during a war, you could run headlong into the power of the state. But in general, we're talking about inconveniences and minor financial liabilities, and also a lack of recognition and respect from the state. What is sometimes, at least in educational matters, regarded as a form of indirect or implicit coercion. That is, the state isn't telling you to do something necessarily, but when it's asking everybody to do this particular thing in class, to read the Bible or say a prayer, for example, then it does subtly coerce the other students in class, even if you don't have to say the prayer. You're not saying the prayer itself. You're not saying the Pledge of Allegiance. So as the government comes to play a greater role in people's lives, people see more ways in which religious liberty might apply, or the First Amendment might apply. And you know, today in healthcare, we see the same thing. Through Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, the government does more in that regard, you know, requires organizations, companies to provide insurance and for people to buy that insurance. And that means that, of course, some are not going to want to do it, and some for religious reasons. And that was not something that people thought about or worried about in the middle of the 19th century, because the federal government wasn't doing those sorts of things.
Well, my guest today is Chris Benecke. He's a professor and associate dean of first-year experience at Bentley University and the author of James Madison and the Moderate Origins of the Religion Clauses, this article in Liberty Magazine. Bringing it back to James Madison, you've mentioned he was a staunch opponent of Bill of Rights and codifying First Amendment rights for a long time. What brought him around?
Madison, he was having conversations all along with Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson thought they needed a Bill of Rights and couldn't believe that Madison didn't see it from his way. Madison also was a political realist and knew in order for the Constitution to get ratified, they were going to need to make concessions. They realized this not long after or during the convention in Pennsylvania. And by the time January and February rolled around and they were debating the Constitution in Massachusetts, it was inevitable that they were going to have to make these concessions. And so the delegates in places like that were saying, let's all vote for this. And what we will do is guarantee we will take these proposals for amendments to the first Congress. And Madison saw this happening, recognized that it was probably going to be a thing. He was still thinking at this point the amendments were going to be incorporated into the document itself and not appended at the end, and didn't really want a Mueller document, but was probably willing to do it. But then really got a push from John Leland and others in his district. We were campaigning first to be a member of the Constitutional Convention or the State Convention, and then later on the first Congress. And they basically, it looks like, we don't know for sure, but that he got an ultimatum, which was you need to endorse, you know, an amendment that protects religious liberty or you won't get our support. And in areas like his, Baptists were able to mobilize a large proportion of the voting public. And Madison knew at this point that he needed to do it. And it was generally in line with the things he believed. It wasn't like it was at odds with his deeply formed convictions about the importance of religious liberty and the sanctity of the conscience. He just couldn't bring himself to think that the Constitution, at least for a while, required this kind of change. But that it was political realities in his own district, political realities at the federal level, and probably the arguments that friends of his, like Jefferson, like John Leland, were making, which ultimately compelled him to go before the first Congress and say, I'd like to propose that we incorporate some amendments. But he didn't do this in a way that you might expect. It was not like, I mean, Madison didn't give loud, galvanizing speeches and passion speeches. He gave very modest ones, diffident ones. Another example of that. And he gave it away too, and this gets us back to the point of the article. He gave it away too, which underscored what he saw as the need to be moderate in terms of the language that was used, the concerns that were addressed, and the feelings of all of those involved. He was not taking a radical position by any means, but suggesting that to assuage the legitimate concerns that people had at the time, including John Leland and others, to assuage their concerns, those who felt vulnerable to the state's power, they should adopt these measures. They may not be entirely necessary, but they couldn't do any harm. And that was the basic principle that he maintained over the next few months.
You title your article, you know, The Moderate Origins of the Religion Clauses, and you describe at length about this spirit of moderation that James Madison adopted as he went about thinking about the First Amendment and advocating for it. How would he have defined that term? I have a strong suspicion that we probably think about it differently and think of the word moderate differently than he would have.
Yeah, we tend to think of it as a political position, something in the center. It's not as though that was completely anathema to the term or his usage of it. But at the time, what it generally meant was a conciliatory attitude towards other people, a willingness to accommodate differences, a gentleness when it came to one's dealings with other people, and a willingness also to entertain the possibility that you might be wrong. So I think that the moderation was more of a temperament, as they saw at the time, as opposed to a designate, you know, or prescribed or a discrete political position. It was a way of going about your life and especially politics, as opposed to any set of political positions within it.
You write about how this spirit of his was influenced by, you know, authors like Montesquieu, Adam Smith, and John Witherspoon. I'm sure there are more, but those are the three I think that you mentioned. Why'd you mention these three? And is there value that we could get from reading them?
Not for any particular reason other than that they were prominent at the time. Madison knew Montesquieu well. He had also, like many framers, he was aware of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And then he had studied under John Witherspoon at Princeton, well, became the College of New Jersey, which became Princeton. So there was a direct influence there of Witherspoon on him. It's also notable that the three of them, Witherspoon, Smith, Montesquieu, very different political and religious backgrounds. And the religious one is maybe most important, you know, that Witherspoon was a very committed Presbyterian and, you know, a minister before college president. And these convictions were neither secular nor religious. They were shared among people who were both deeply religious and had a lot of skepticism about religion. But the idea that you needed to take this approach and that it was an appropriate one for doctrinal matters, but also matters of state, I think that's notable about this.
Obviously, Congress adopted the Bill of Rights, and we got these, you know, the first 10 amendments that codified the rights that they enjoyed, you know, back in the earliest days of, you know, the American founding. Very grateful that they did nowadays. How did Madison's moderate approach to politics and discussing these matters, if at all, how did that influence the debate and compel Congress to, you know, codify these rights?
It succeeded. I mean, maybe that's the most important thing to keep in mind is that it worked. That it was if you wanted a Bill of Rights, it was at least one path to getting there, one plausible path, and it worked. So there's that to be said for it. It might have, in some ways, influenced the language that we got at the end. We don't know this for sure. We know Madison probably would have liked language that restricted what states could do, but that was not in the cards for most members of Congress at the time. And so he, in advocating for this approach, which would ameliorate the concerns that people who felt vulnerable at the time, I think that moderate approach manifests itself probably in the relative indifference that members of Congress had to the particular words that were used and the lack of specificity in them. That is, he felt compelled to include these amendments, to advocate for them. He felt compelled to ensure that there was some mention of religious liberty in them. But once he had done the work that he promised, which was a political job, but also one to assuage the consciences, the worries of those who felt vulnerable, he didn't need to do a whole lot more. Didn't feel like he needed to do a whole lot more because, again, this federal government wasn't supposed to do much. It was the real power was going to reside in the states and did for many decades thereafter. So even though it was vague, this language, and could be put to many uses, and we, as we know, has been in the last few decades, uses that they couldn't have imagined because they lived in a much different world, it still contains some of that spirit that is not overly restrictive and open to new possibilities and relatively limited in its application. All those things you might ascribe to his moderate approach to this. Also, it may have had nothing to do with it. The language we may have gotten that language anyway, but the two things did coincide.
How does James Madison's like moderate approach to this and his slow and measured reasoning illustrate the American political sensibilities of his time?
There were people, I mean, we talked about Witherspoon in the writings of Adam Smith, which were influential at the time. There were many people living in the 1780s, influential people especially, who thought that this was the key to government, that moderation in some form or another was the key. And George Washington, in many ways, embodied this. So Washington, I don't believe he regularly used the term moderation, but he did talk about ensuring that people were able to live at peace under their own vine and fig tree. And he repeatedly emphasized the importance of decorum, of civility, of treating people, even those you didn't like or entirely, I don't know if respect is the right word, but even people whose sanity you may have suspected. There were religious groups, I think, at the time who were pretty extreme and who Washington thought were a little bit off their rocker. But he nonetheless, he was considerate in his responses to them when they wrote to him. He wrote back to them in a very diplomatic way and a very kind way and emphasized the things that they had in common. And we would say a few things, maybe about providence or God, not anything more specific than that, you know, talk about shared civic values. And I think that that approach, that is an emphasis on the minimum number of things we need to have in common to get along and to act together as Americans, I think that embodies this moderate spirit. We're not asking you to believe anything or necessarily to do a lot of things. We're asking you to be decent to one another, to act peacefully, and to work together to advance this democratic experiment of ours. I think those, you know, that sort of minimalist conception of what a person had to believe and what they had to commit, at least dogmatically, I think that in many ways embodies this era.
It's distressing to me a little bit that I don't think I could just speak for all people and say, I think we all want civility, because it does seem like there is a population that, you know, sees violence as an answer to our opponents in America today. But I think there is also a population that would want to return to reclaiming that American identity of civility and of careful, reasoned thinking, especially in politics. How do we reclaim that?
Oh, it's really hard. I wish I had the answer. It's so hard, especially in the age of social media. All the incentives are to cultivate outrage and to embrace that outrage. And so it's going to be very hard for us. And, you know, all the algorithms obviously steer us in that direction. So it's going to be hard. You know, I think what it requires in many ways is an offline, in-person experience with your fellow citizens, doing things together, talking together. That's the avenue I think that would be most helpful for all of us. Going down and visiting election stations, you know, and seeing what happens there, like together, like, you know, how does this work exactly? Like talking about that sort of thing, visiting civic groups of various kinds. I think all those things where we're in person, we're not shielded by an online identity and actually have to face each other. I think that would give me hope. If we could find ways of mobilizing ourselves to do that kind of work, I'd feel a lot better. Whether we can or not is another question. If we remain on social media, our prospects are somewhat dim. But if we can get off it, and this includes me, I think we'll be better off.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, history professor Dr. Chris Beneke, talking about his article, James Madison and the Moderate Origins of the Religion Clauses. You can read it by going to libertymagazine.org. On tomorrow's program, it's Chris Maloney on the various aspects of church safety and security.
The more gray hair and brown bellies you see tells you you're going to have a medical. So let's get ready. You know, let's be prepared. Let's get some first aid, CPR. You know, let's buy some medical equipment. Let's take common sense steps to safeguard our congregations.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.